This is Where We Live.
What is the best design you've encountered?
There's two things. There's, of course, 9/11. And there's a cafe in Vienna that was designed by Luz, who was an architect at the turn of the century. And I think he was probably the best architect that ever lived.
I love Trump Tower in New York. I just think the design is awesome.
I would say cathedral in Washington, D.C., the Catholic Cathedral. That's a beautiful design.
I'd have to say the best design that I ever saw was a 1967 GT Shelby Cobra.
And what is the worst design?
The Etzel. It was just poorly designed from the beginning. It just never sold, and it was a very poor car.
The worst? I don't know. An Etzel.
The things that you find, like in Williams-Sonoma, that are not for cooks who are cooks, like the design for an item that's supposed to take the pit out of the avocado and slice it for you. I don't know. I'm from Mexico. You have to know an avocado.
Those are some ideas collected on the streets of West Hartford by WNPR's Skylar Magnoli. Boy, people are still talking about the Etzel all these years later. So what is design? It's all of those things they mentioned, of course, but it's also the iPhone, the Prius, and the butterfly ballot. Yeah, the ballot design that helped to throw the 2000 election in Florida into chaos. Design is evident in the pleasing feeling we have in a lovely public park and the gruesome experience at the DMV. But what's the real difference between good design and bad? What are the ways we can think about design differently that positively impact our lives? You can join our conversation about design today, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. We'd love to hear your thoughts about design that works and design that fails miserably. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can also tweet us at Where We Live. And as always, we've got a conversation ongoing at WNPR.org. In just a moment, I'll bring in Dr. Henry Petrosky from Duke University. But I want to welcome in our first guest, Alice Rosthorne, who is a design writer for the International New York Times. She's an author, and her latest book is called Hello World, Where Design Meets Life. It's also a beautifully designed book. Alice, welcome to our program.
Hi, John. Delighted to be here.
Could you explain to us what you think design really is?
Well, it's a very complicated phenomenon, and its meaning has changed in different times and in different contexts. But I think design has always had one elemental meaning through the centuries, and that is to be an agent of change that can help us to respond to changes in many different areas of our lives, whether they're economic, environmental, social, political, scientific, technological, and to turn them into things that can improve our quality of life rather than detract from it.
When we asked people on the streets about what good design was and what poor design was, we got some responses that hinted at innovation. But essentially, I think a lot of people, Alice, think design is a nice-looking version of something we've seen before, you know, a skyscraper that's particularly elegant or a beautiful old church. Is that part of what design is, or are we thinking too narrowly when we think about design as a really good-looking building?
Well, it's part of what design is, but it really is only part. And there are many misconceptions of design. And one of the reasons I wrote Hello World, Where Design Meets Life was to attempt to redress some of them. But the most popular misconception is that design is solely a styling tool. It's only about visual appearance. Now, that always has been a role of design, and there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, one of the people you spoke to talked about Adolf Loos's cafes in Vienna, and they are absolutely delightful places to be in. It's just that there's so much more to design than that, and I think it can be dangerous if people just focus on its visual or stylistic aspects, if they're not looking at equally, if not more important, elements of design, its relationship to technology, its cultural impact, its usability, something that whenever we pick up a new digital device, we come up against every day.
I used the example at the very top of the program of the butterfly ballot in Florida, the ballot that in some ways helped to contribute to the chaos of the 2000 presidential election here in the United States. Explain a little bit about why design in that way, a fairly mundane item, can cause so many problems. What's the difference between a ballot that is well designed and one that's poorly designed?
Well, the kerfuffle over the butterfly ballot is actually, although bizarre though the outcome was, and some people argue that it actually changed the outcome of the entire election rather than simply affecting the election itself, but powerful though its impact was, it is actually a brilliant example of bad design, and also unintentionally bad design, because it began with really the best of intentions. One of the election officials in Florida realized that a lot of voters who had poor sight found it very difficult to read the tiny print on the electoral ballot, and so anxious to redress this, she actually found it was impossible, given the design of the ballot boxes, to make the ballot much bigger. So she decided to opt for what's called a butterfly ballot. And so this is running two lines of the candidates, or rather two columns of the candidates, side by side. And so the voting paper literally opens up like the wings of a butterfly. So it's like a folded page. So obviously this was a noble endeavor done to make sure that the outcome of the election was as accurate as possible. But unfortunately, because of the juxtaposition between the lines on which you voted for Al Gore, the Democratic candidate for that presidential election, and Pat Buchanan, whose politics were obviously very, very different, right at the opposite end of the political scale, a number of Democratic supporters complained after the election that they thought they had mistakenly voted for Buchanan, thinking they'd voted for Gore. Another problem was a difficulty with the voting machines, which meant that a great many of the ballots were actually spoiled, an unusually high percentage of them. And all of which flung the election into chaos, the technical error that resulted in so many ballots being spoiled, but also the confusion between whether people were actually voting for Gore and Buchanan. Now, many people within the Democratic Party are absolutely convinced that without those differences, Al Gore would have won the election. And of course, there was a very famous court case to deliberate over it, and in the end, Gore and the Democrats sort of stepped aside rather than throw the whole governmental system into chaos. But that is a crystal clear example about how somebody with very good intentions made a design decision that seemed to make an awful lot of sense, but which actually had devastating consequences.
The key word to me that you used in that analysis was the word confusion. And confusion is at the heart of really bad design. I'll give you a much less important example from my weekend, which is I went to go see a show at a club, and I, in the middle of the show, I went to go find the restroom, and I couldn't find which one was the men's room and which one was the woman's room. There was some beautiful design in many ways inside the building. They were trying to make it as though it would be something that was pleasing to the eye, but I walked into the women's room because I couldn't tell one from the other. This is, I think, at the heart of the confusion you're talking about here, whether or not it's walking in the wrong door, standing in the wrong line at the DMV, or voting for Pat Buchanan when you want to vote for Al Gore. Any design that is confusing to you is something that in many ways fails, Alice, right?
Oh, absolutely. And if you're lucky, the consequences are purely irritating or embarrassing, as in the case of you going into the women's room. I, of course, have made the opposite mistake for exactly the same reason. But if, say, you think of walking through an airport, which is a completely artificial environment in which getting to the right place at absolutely the right time is essential. You know, the consequences of missing a flight can be horrendous for many people, stressful, expensive, and deeply problematic. I mean, how many people have sort of looked up at the signs in an airport and felt furious and frustrated? They have absolutely no idea where they're supposed to be going, which direction they're going to be heading in, and whether they're still proceeding in the correct way. Now, that's yet another example of design, rather like the signs on the restroom doors, where actually enabling us to make sense of the world, to navigate our way around it efficiently and effortlessly, is absolutely critical. And in cases like that, bad design can end in confusion and much worse. But perhaps unfairly, good design is often unrecognized, because for a functional piece of design like a signage system, the best possible examples of design are so good we don't even have to think about them.
We're talking with Alice Rossthorne, who's a design writer and author. Her latest book is Hello World, Where Design Meets Life. We want to hear your thoughts about design that works in your life, things that make your life easier, 860-275-7266, and of course, those things that are failures as well. I want to bring into the conversation Dr. Henry Petrosky, who's a professor of civil engineering at Duke University. He's authored several books, including To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. Dr. Petrosky, welcome to Where We Live.
Well, thank you.
Before I get to this idea of failure in design and why it's so important, maybe you could give me a brief description, as Alice did, on what you think good design is and what you think poor design is.
Well, I think good design is anticipating failure and building in characteristics to the design that make failure virtually impossible. You talked about signage, and she talked about signage at airports. Whoever is designing that signage should think, can a person looking for the men's room or the woman's room be confused? If so, the design should be altered to make that impossible. It can still have aesthetic values, but it doesn't have to be confusing.
When you talk about failure analysis, what exactly do you mean? How do you pull apart the failure of design and actually help to improve things in the future?
Well, you look at where it doesn't work. If, again, the men's room and women's room can't be distinguished, that's a clear failure of communication. And then the analysis of it is to try to understand where the points of confusion are.
But I think, as Alice said, you know, that's a case where it's maybe a little bit embarrassing. In the case of a butterfly ballot, maybe it's a case where someone has voted in the wrong, and that's certainly not something to take lightly. But there's failure in structures all the time. There's failure in buildings. There's failure in bridges. And these things, Henry, can have a much higher cost. How do we make sure, by learning from failures, that we are designing something that will not only succeed, but be safe, be something that we can live with in our lives?
Well, again, it's anticipating failure. The important thing in design is to think about how failure can occur. This is what engineers do all the time. Their calculations that ensure that failure won't occur basically assume that failure is going to happen in this particular way. It's only when engineers and others become careless and focus perhaps more on aesthetics or cost or speed that they tend to overlook critical issues. There is a phenomenon that in the wake of failure, such as now we've seen Malaysia 370 has been missing for over a month now, clearly there is going to be a serious rethinking about the black boxes and how they can be found in accidents of this kind. When there is no failure, when there's no airplane crash for years, and that's what we've experienced in this country virtually, I don't remember the last time there's been a serious airplane crash, we tend to get relaxed. We think, well, we've got the design perfected. We don't need to study it any further or analyze it any further. It's the failures that are the wake-up calls that make us focus then on improvement, and then that leads to success. So in my book, I talk about cycles of success and failure. We're human beings, and we like to think that we got it right. So that leads to a sense of hubris, a sense of overconfidence, a sense of casualness. And I would think it's not unlike that in cases of design generally.
Alice, before we take our first break, I'd like to get your comments on this idea that we innovate around design during cycles. Something happens in our world to change our circumstance. And just even talking about the airport, so much has changed since 9/11 about the way we fly and the way in which we encounter TSA, etc. There's a lot that drives design innovation that comes from things that happen in the world, but you also write about those designers who are trying to think beyond the thing that just happened and trying to innovate. That must be a very different discipline, I would think, designing to overcome a failure that's happened versus designing to dream up what may be the next thing.
Well, I really do believe that design is a combination of the two. I mean, Henry is absolutely correct in saying that design should avoid failure, and designers, engineers, and other specialists must learn from what's gone wrong, from the lessons of the past. But I believe that, and this is obviously a huge generalization, but to produce really great design, those sort of wonderful leaps of ingenuity, the wonderfully inspiring and enlightening design projects that really transform our lives, we have to do that, but also be more ambitious as well. And truly great design almost always has a dream element in it. And of course design is rooted in its time, as you said. I mean, an example would be the design of devices to help people with disabilities, whether they're wheelchairs or prosthetic limbs. And if you look back through history, the key catalyst for the sort of really wonderful leaps in those products have always been the most tragic ones, war and conflict. So it was after the Vietnam War, for example, when there was a huge number of veterans who were coming back to the United States who needed prosthetic limbs and wheelchairs, that there was a huge leap in wheelchair technology. And we have the sort of very sporty, high-tech wheelchairs that have become common since. And similarly, recent wars like the Gulf War, and again, more amputee veterans, triggered another leap in research and development and design, which has really transformed not only wheelchairs, but also prosthetics technology. So we have the incredible superhuman prosthetic limbs that we're seeing people use now. And I think they're wonderful examples of learning from failure. If you talk to anybody who had to wear prosthetic limbs in the 1970s and 1980s, they will tell you how uncomfortable, destabilizing, inefficient, and unfit for purpose they were. But it is also dreaming to produce something that's really so much better, that in many cases can create quite extraordinary new abilities, aesthetic effects, or whatever for the people who wear them.
We're talking with Alice Rossthorne, who's a design writer for the International New York Times, amongst other publications. Her latest book is called Hello World, Where Design Meets Life, and we're talking about design in our world. Also, we're talking with Dr. Henry Petrosky, who's a professor of civil engineering at Duke University. Among his books is To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. When we come back, we'll get some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 about how good and bad design affects your life. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We were inspired by a new book called Hello World, Where Design Meets Life, by the design writer Alice Rossthorne. She joins us today to talk about design in our lives, along with Henry Petrosky, who is from Duke University. We're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. So let's go to Vince, who is calling from Farmington. Hello, Vince. You're on Where We Live.
Well, thank you. I think I may have read one of Dr. Petrosky's books. I'm not sure. I think the title of it was something like To Design as Human. In any case, I've been curious for a long time about why the building collapsed in Hartford. It was only 10 years old, the Civic Center. 15,000 people left the building hours before it collapsed. And it was a calamity, and I think it had to do with design. So I'd love to hear, I'm sure Dr. Petrosky knows about it, and I'd like to hear his comments on it.
Vince, thank you very much. And Henry Petrosky, if you heard Vince's comment talking about the 70s collapse of the Hartford Civic Center, something that our Colin McEnroe has explored, if you want to go on WNPR.org and search for that, you can find out more about that event. Do you remember that event?
Yes, I do. I've written about that. It was a very complicated design called a space frame, the roof. It had members going in all different directions, very three-dimensional. And before the computer, the digital computer, it's something that engineers probably would not have attempted on such a scale. But the new computer was so promising that the structure was modeled in the computer. And unfortunately, again, the computer being new, people were not as familiar with it or its limitations as they should have been. The structure was modeled in the computer improperly. The computer said it was safe, but obviously it wasn't. To make a long story short, the construction crew said this isn't behaving the way we think it should be behaving, but the engineers said, well, the computer says it is. So, well, the computer lost. And since then, that's been a lesson, of course. People are much more reluctant to just take a computer's word for it.
Alice Rossthorne, we have a tweet here from Rachel, and she asks, do principles of design apply only to tangible things, like the Hartford Civic Center roof, or to ideas and theories? I think I know your answer, but maybe you can flesh that out a little bit, because people do obsess about the things in our lives that we consider design, and we don't think enough about the ideas behind them.
Indeed. And, of course, the things in our lives and the design quality of them are incredibly important. But design is a much, much broader concept than that, as the tweet suggests. And I think that one of the really heartening things that's happened in design in recent years is that certainly within design practice, there has been an acceptance that the design process has a value in itself over and above the things it has conventionally produced, and that the process of evaluation, analysis, communication, and visualization that produces design projects of any type can also be applied to abstract issues. So there's a growing genre, for example, of what are called social designers, who are applying the design process to find new solutions to acute social problems, whether it's homelessness, caring for seniors, improving the standard of education. There's a fantastic project in the United States called Studio H, which is an experimental high school design course that began in Bertie County, Northern Carolina, one of the poorest rural areas of the United States, and is now at a school in Berkeley, California. And this seeks to teach design and making to high school students of about 16 and 17 years old. And the idea is that it's not necessarily training them to become designers, but that it will give them a series of intellectual and creative tools that can help them for the rest of their lives, whether it's in communication, lateral thinking, and so on. And design is increasingly being used in these sort of non-physical abstract areas of the whole range of spheres of our life. Commercial design groups, for example, are applying a similar process to trying to improve the management and delivery of healthcare services.
One of the things, of course, baked into our new world is the idea that green design must be a part of many or most things that we do, that are items should be sustainable in their creation, that the way we live should reflect something that's good for the environment along the way. Alice, in your analysis, how difficult is that to consider making something that is beautiful and functional? It's costs the right price so that people will want to buy it, but then it also, at the end of the day, doesn't damage our environment. This is an added complication over the course of the last few decades that all designers are grappling with.
It's an added complication, but it's also an incredibly exciting opportunity for designers, because, as I said, designers are agents of change. And so just as, say, in the late years of the 19th and early years of the 20th century, they were grappling with how to turn electricity, which was becoming more and more accessible to more and more people, into a positive force in our lives, and how in recent decades they've grappled with digital technology in the same way, enabling us to live more environmentally responsibly and sustainably is another huge challenge, very, very difficult, very arduous, but also a really thrilling opportunity for designers now. And I think it will be, when design historians look back and historians in general look back on our time, this will be seen as one of the great challenges. And it is one that has proved both very rewarding but also deeply problematic for designers. And I find that when I buy standard consumer goods, maybe it's a new washing machine or a dishwasher, I'm frequently appalled by the low levels of design in terms of the environmental responsibility of those units. There tends to be a lot of sort of posturing and boosterism about how green and environmentally responsible they are from the manufacturers in their instruction manuals and all the marketing material. But when you actually look at something as simple as, say, how the product can be disposed of at the end of its useful life, you realize how little investment has been made in this field. And I personally believe that in recent years, our definition of good design has evolved. And so if we have any reason to feel uncomfortable about the ethical implications or environmental implications of a product or any other design project, I really believe it cannot be considered good or desirable design. And this is something that designers have absolutely got to grapple with, no matter how difficult it might be.
Henry Prochosky, we have a little less than a minute left, but would you agree in the way designers have to grapple with this additional need to make their products more sustainable for our environment?
Yes, I think there's a great deal of thinking in that direction. On the larger scale with structures, there's a movement called the LEED movement, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, in which buildings are made to be energy efficient. They're made to be not wasteful of materials. They're made out of materials that are locally made as much as possible, so there isn't a lot of energy spent in transporting goods across the country or around the world, for that matter, and so forth and so on. The roofs are being made green so that they can not only help in cooling the building in the summer, but also provide outdoor environments for the people working in the building that are pleasant. There is a great deal of thinking and really progress being made in this front.
Dr. Henry Prochosky is professor of civil engineering at Duke University, the author of several books about design, including To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. Thank you so much, sir, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Alice Rossthorne, design writer for the International New York Times. She inspired our conversation with her new book called Hello World, Where Design Meets Life. Great to speak with you, Alice. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll talk to Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin about her latest book, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's been 1 year since the Boston Marathon bombing, which killed 3 people and wounded hundreds more. But it also changed the city of Boston, which was essentially shut down during the ensuing manhunt for the bombing suspects. Coming up, we'll look back at that long week in April, how things have changed there and in the rest of the country, really, since the bombing. We'll hear from people who were at the marathon that day, including a local professor who will once again run in this year's race. I hope you can join us tomorrow here on Where We Live. Medea Benjamin is an American political activist and co-founder of Code Pink. Her latest book is called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. On this Wednesday, Promoting Enduring Peace will present her with the 2014 Gandhi Peace Award at the United Church on the Green in New Haven. You can find out more about that event at peepeace.org. That's peepeace.org. She joins us by phone right now. Medea Benjamin, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
For people who aren't familiar with Code Pink, explain exactly what your movement's all about.
We started as a movement to try to stop the U.S. from invading Iraq, which had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. And ever since that, we've been working to try to move U.S. policy towards one that focuses too much on a military response and spends too much on a bloated military, to one that focuses more on diplomacy, lifting people out of poverty, and improving conditions here at home, where there are so many issues that need both our resources as well as our energy and our know-how and our expertise.
What impact do you think that you've had over the course of time? Clearly, since the end of the Iraq War, some things in the way the United States has approached the world have changed. Other things very much have not, and we'll be talking about the drone program in just a moment. But do you think that U.S. Foreign policy has shifted in any way, shape, or form?
I think it shifted because the American people have realized after a decade of war that war is not the answer, that the countries where we were supposed to make life better have not have seen that improvement from the U.S. military involvement, that it's drained trillions of dollars from our resources, left so many of our soldiers either dead or with terrible injuries. And so when we see attempts to move our country into war, as in the cases with Syria and Iran recently, the response from the American people was overwhelming, crossing all kinds of ideological spectrums to say that we do not want to get involved in more wars. So I think that sentiment has forced our government to look for diplomatic solutions, and I think that's a positive development over these last couple of years.
Of course, something we've seen in just the course of the last several months is that in certain parts of the world, foreign leaders believe force still works. When Russia decides to take by force a section of Ukraine and the rest of the world stands by, it seems, Medea, as though many people are left with this notion that by, I think as John Kerry said, by moving in a 19th century way into another land and taking their property, that this is still something that works in the world. How do we counteract that? Many people say that U.S. foreign policy is too weak because we do too much time talking and we allow things like this to happen. It is a complex world.
Well, I think maybe one way that we could start countering that is to admit our own mistakes and to recognize that things like the invasion of Iraq have been disastrous. I think that conversation has never been had with the American people, with the military itself and government officials owning up to the fact that we left Iraq in such disastrous straits with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people killed, certainly millions displaced. What has it done for us here at home? We haven't had these conversations. Let's look back at the time of Vietnam. I think if we were more honest about how our military intervention has led to such disastrous consequences. We could even look at the case of Libya, where many Americans might think that it was a quick U.S. military involvement, overthrew a dictatorship of Gaddafi, and that the Libyan people are now happy and there's a stable society there. That is not the case. So I think owning up to our own responsibility for promoting militarism and then acting like it has been a solution would be a good place for us to start.
One thing that's always confounding, though, for U.S. policy, being the world's only true superpower, as it were, able to project its military might and its technological might and its workforce around the entire world, is dealing with people who don't play by the same rules as us. Vladimir Putin is one example, but you mentioned Libya and we've had Iraq. From your standpoint, how might the U.S. best address world leaders who are acting not in the interest of the rest of the world, sometimes killing their own people, and doing it in a way that throws aside any notions we have about right and wrong?
Well, you seem to be coming from the premise that the U.S. is the good guy on the world stage, and I want to get at that because I think that the U.S. has been involved in so many nasty activities, whether it's torture, the continued existence of the Guantanamo prison, or invasion of other countries, not next door, not that that's an excuse, but Ukraine is next door to Russia, but thousands and thousands of miles away, like Iraq. That does not make us the good guys on the international stage. We're also the only country in the world that has over 800 foreign military bases on other people's soil, oftentimes in countries where they don't want us. These kinds of things do set an example, and I have seen around the world that where there have been abuses of human rights, people will say to me, aha, but look at what your own country has done in Guantanamo, in Abu Ghraib, in the black sites with extraordinary rendition. So the best place for us to start is cleaning up our own policies. Mm.
Medea Benjamin's American political activist, co-founder of Code Pink. Her latest book is called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. She's getting the Gandhi Peace Award at the United Church on the Green in New Haven. Coming up this year, or actually coming up on Wednesday, she's getting the 2014 Gandhi Peace Award. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. That's a good place to turn to the impact that you believe that the United States drone warfare has had on how we are perceived around the world. Is that, in your mind, the biggest problem here, Medea, is that we're conducting a war that is a remote control war that has so many people looking at us and saying, how can you continue to kill people from so far away?
Well, that's another example, as do as I say, not as I do, where the U.S. is conducting drone warfare. And for your listeners, that means that the president of the United States acts as prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. People are not allowed to surrender. How do you surrender to a drone? People are not accused of anything, given a trial. This is just summary executions from the sky being done by people from the safety of a U.S. airbase in the United States, pressing a button and killing people thousands of miles away who we know very little about. And this is setting an example to the rest of the world that I think is a terrible example. And as one former U.S. spokesman for the White House said, I'd hate to have to be the one to in a position of berating another country for this kind of extrajudicial execution when the U.S. is doing it all the time.
The one argument that is made by U.S. officials who support the continued use, limited but continued use of a drone program, is that they are able to make targeted strikes against people who they know do not have the interests of the U.S. in mind, and they don't have to send in large numbers of troops, possibly putting more lives at risk. So when people say that to you, U.S. officials or otherwise, what do you tell them?
I say that's part of the same kind of policy of thinking that we can kill our way into having people like us rather than using the rule of law, capturing people and giving them trials and abiding by Geneva Conventions, international law, U.S. Constitution. That's the way to show the world that we are a superior democratic power. So I think that whether it's killing by remote control or whether it's thinking that we can go and invade another country and inflict on the people what I call collective punishment, which is what the drones are doing because they terrify entire populations, this is only making more enemies. And if you want any proof of that, just look at the last 12 years. We, the largest military power by far in the entire world, have not been able to conquer the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. In fact, Al-Qaeda, according to our own government, is more powerful today than it was 12 years ago, now existing in 16 different countries. So if anything, we're just spreading Al-Qaeda, and the drones are one of the best recruiting tools that Al-Qaeda has.
Can the type of change that you're talking about in U.S. foreign policy happen through the political arena, or does it have to happen through the type of activism that you engage in? Do you believe that there's any room for people who are part of the American political spectrum to say some of the things that you're saying, to talk about some of the changes that you're talking about?
Well, that's a great question, because I think if the same thing were happening under the Bush administration, there'd be a whole lot of Democrats who'd be up in arms and saying, how in the world can we be doing these targeted assassinations, killing thousands of people by drones, not giving them a chance to have a trial? This is not the American way. We can't be doing this. And we probably would have seen a very quick halt to that program. But because it's carried out by the Obama administration, these Democratic allies have been pretty much silent throughout this whole period. And so I think the political system is not working for us, which is why it's up to then individuals who are not tied to political parties, but tied to morals and values and international law. It then calls upon us to be the ones to speak out and sound the alarm.
Moving outside of U.S. foreign policy for a moment, earlier this year, Code Pink formed a U.S. delegation of women to travel to Gaza for International Women's Day. During that trip, you wound up in Cairo, and you were placed in an Egyptian jail upon your arrival. Why were you detained there?
Well, it's still a mystery to me, since we had been collaborating with the Egyptian government to tell them we were coming, provide them with the information so that we could travel through Egypt to get to the border of Gaza. But when we arrived, something terrible went awry, and instead I was detained and then violently beaten, dragged, my arm dislocated, and thrown onto a plane and deported. So I don't know what happened, because the Egyptian government has never given any response as to why it suddenly changed and why I was treated so violently, except that the Egyptian government in power right now is one that came to power through a military coup and has killed over 1,000 people. Some 20,000 people are in jail because of political activities. And they have recently just sentenced 529 people to death in a trial for the killing of one policeman, a trial that lasted 2 days. And in the second day, even the defendant's lawyers were not allowed into the courtroom. So seen by the entire world community as a sham. And I think my treatment was just a minor reflection of the thuggish way that the Egyptian government is now functioning.
What were you doing in Egypt and Gaza? What were you trying to accomplish there?
We were trying to go to Gaza for International Women's Day, because women in Gaza feel that they have been forgotten by the international community, that their lives are so difficult, that they are under siege, not able to travel outside their country for medical treatment, for school abroad, that inside they are suffering from a economic crisis that has left them without means to take care of their families, and that they wanted us to help shine the light on their difficult situation, but unfortunately we were not able to get there.
That situation in Gaza is one that has been intractable for quite some time. Do you feel as though international activism can play some role in the lives of the women of Gaza?
Well, on the very small humanitarian aid, we were bringing in lanterns, solar lamps, because they have such a difficulty with electricity these days. We were bringing in some medicines that are hard to get hold of. So those are some small drops in the buckets of being able to help individual people. On the larger scale, I think it's important when there are communities who are suffering and where there is, it's very hard for the media to get in and out and be able to expose, that citizens take it upon themselves. And I've done this in many times in my life. In fact, started an organization called Global Exchange precisely to have these kinds of citizen delegations that focus on places that are either hard to get to or where the U.S. is having a difficult relationship, to pave the way for the kinds of things that we oftentimes would like our government to be doing.
Medea Benjamin's an American political activist, co-founder of Code Pink. Her latest book is called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. I look forward to being in New Haven on Wednesday.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Here are some colleagues who will tell you how to support conversations like this on WNPR.